It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Okay, it's been 5 months. Abby Martin is with us again. Thank you so much. At Telesaur, host of the Empire Files, been doing some awesome work. We're going to talk about a lot of the stuff that you've been working on. But just, I mean, right before we started, just tell us, you said you haven't been paid for a couple months because of, I mean, what is going on in Venezuela? Just let's talk about it.
Yeah, so we can get into the nuances of this later, but basically the sanctions have been so debilitating and they've been exacerbated by the Trump administration. So, of course, before even the elections happened, the sanctions were so crippling, it was virtually impossible to transfer any money in and out of Caracas. Because even though Telesaur is funded by six Latin American countries, the base is still in Caracas. So, you know, they like to paint these sanctions as just on corrupt government officials. We all know that sanctions are actually an act of war, and they're designed to hurt vulnerable sectors of the population, obviously, and exacerbate, obviously, the economic problems that we'll later use to justify more sanctions. So it's a never-ending cycle. And what the sanctions are doing is making it impossible for Telesaur to function. Tons of journalists have been forced to leave. Luckily, I've been able to do other things to sustain my life in the last couple months, but it's just unbelievable that no one's talking about this underhanded attack. You know, RT is obviously much more attacked in the light. You have the FAR registration, you have it being blamed for Trump's election. You know, the list goes on and on. But for Telesaur, it's like as if nothing's happening. And it's just a way for the establishment to shut it down without even making it a news story. So I'm hoping that we're going to pull through. But I mean, it just shows you how debilitating sanctions can be. And of course, the Trump administration slapped even more sanctions on for the crime of having an election. So, you know, Venezuela is this dictatorship. And then every time they have an election, they get sanctioned for having an election. So that's where we're at today.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about Venezuela and also Colombia and some of the work that you've done around that media wise later. I just think it's interesting because outside of, you know, the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan and, you know, a couple of airstrikes against Assad in Syria, Trump is painted as this, you know, hands-off, non-interventionist president.
That's disgusting. this whole argument is batshit crazy, man. I don't understand. He's exacerbated drone strikes over 400%. He's carpet bombing neighborhoods. He's upped the military presence in almost every country. He wants to privatize all our armed forces in Afghanistan. He's like boys with genocidal criminal Christian supremacist Eric Prince. I mean, any way you slice it is absolutely mind-numbing how anyone can justify that other than maybe the Korea thing, which we'll get into. And I don't believe that means he's non-intervention. I mean, look at who he surrounded himself with, the most rabid neoconservatives, right, who are just, you know, have bloodlust.
Right. Exactly. Well, we talked 5 months ago, about 2 months ago or so, you know, the ex-head of the CIA stated that soon Trump would be moved into the dustbin of history. I know 5 months ago we were kind of, you know, talking about, you know, major tensions within the elites, you know, would Trump be pushed aside? Would he be impeached? So on and so forth. Do you think there remains a sizable push from the elite sections to remove Trump, or are we still at the same place we were 5 months ago? Do you think there's any chance that he's going to be gone before 2020, or is this still just more of a fantasy, even more than it was last time?
Man, I don't know. I mean, the impasse that we're at now is very peculiar because at the beginning it seemed like, you know, first of all, the establishment is comprised of different factions. So it's, mm-hmm. we shouldn't paint this with a broad brush and be like, oh, you know, this Trump is anti-deep state thing is a mind-numbing argument, because I think that he represents the deep state in a lot of ways. And he surrounded himself with, you know, the factions that were more outliers during the Bush and Obama administration, because they were too fucking crazy. It's the evangelical wings. It's like the more hawk, the John Boltons, who was even too crazy for Bush. So, and the Giulianis, I mean, these are the people who are just extremists to no end. I don't understand how that makes them anti-deep state or anti-globalist. I mean, we know that that's a total farce. So I think what it all stems from is Trump scorched the earth. I mean, when he was running for president, he made so many enemies. And that's where you see, I think, a lot of the pushback on him now. I mean, he made a lot of enemies. He embarrassed a lot of people. People really vehemently hate him for the wrong reasons. And so you have these different factions infighting, where you have David Frum and Bill Kristol suddenly being rebranded as the new resistance leaders, when we know ultimately they want the same things that Trump does. It's just that Trump makes empire and capitalism more unpalatable to sell to the rest of the world. So that's really where the factions come from. Like, the people hate Trump and the establishment, and the empire doesn't want him representing them for very obvious reasons. I mean, look at how much we're isolating ourselves now and the rest of the world. So to answer your question, I do think that people are still scrambling. They're scrambling because they don't know what to do. And all the neoliberals obviously have lost power, and they continue to lose every election. I almost think it's on purpose at this point. I don't think anyone should count on him getting impeached. I mean, here he has been violating the emoluments clause from day one. The China, he was like telling Americans that he was going to bail out a Chinese phone company. It's like, what fucking Flint, dude? We have no like clean water in Flint. You're talking about bailing out a Chinese phone company? I mean, it's just mind numbing. So I think that the only hope with an impeachment, which I would love for him to be impeached, because I don't think Pence has the same cult of personality with like a brown shirt, right, fascist base. But I think that the only hope that we have at this point is somehow some perjury trap. Again, we're looking at a Republican-dominated House and Senate, which they want Trump to railroad their policies through, because I don't know who can be next after Trump. So then again, you have Rudy Giuliani going out there and making all these waves saying Trump can pardon himself, getting the media in this tizzy. I mean, is this a distraction? Where, while Trump is this internet troll, is a distraction to have the media hyper-focus on these news cycles whenever Trump tweets or Giuliani says something crazy? Meanwhile, he's just steamrolling this evangelical agenda all over the country. So I don't know, man. I mean, I don't even know what to think. Honestly, the Democrats want us to sit back and not fight any of his policies. Meanwhile, they're supporting and nominating all of the craziest people. Last but not least, Gina Haspel. This is a sadistic woman who enjoyed torturing. This is what happens when you don't prosecute torture. Come back and actually run the CIA. So at the end of the day, I think that they're going to keep positing and posturing themselves as, you know, the resistance, obviously, because that's the brand. But at the crux of the matter, they're not actually resisting the core policies of Trump. Mm-hmm. It's all just very reality show-esque, dog and pony, wag the dog shit going on. Meanwhile, Trump's actual policies really don't pose that much of a threat to empire and the establishment. In fact, you know, defense contractors' stocks have never been higher.
Mm-hmm. Well, just turning now to North Korea, I mean, what happened? You brought that up, but what happened in this situation? I mean, Trump, you know, everything from Rocket Man, and then all of a sudden he's patting himself on the back for setting up these talks, and then now they're called off. So what exactly is going on there?
Man, this is another confusing one. I think that, look, Trump talks out of both sides of his mouth, so we can never take anything he says seriously. He's a total con artist, and that's obviously why he is where he is. But a couple interesting things about this. So first of all, why the hell is the U.S. empire have a say in the future of the Korean Peninsula? I mean, that should be first and foremost. Why is it up to the U.S. whether these talks proceed? So that really pisses me off. I mean, we all know why, obviously, that, you know, the U.S. has been keeping Korea at war for the last, you know, 70 years, 60 years. So when Trump announced that he wanted to make peace with Kim Jong-un, I think it was a really big shock for people because, like you said, I mean, he was issuing genocidal threats flippantly every other week. He said he wanted to totally obliterate them. He brought on John Bolton, who a couple months prior had just written an op-ed saying we should preemptively bomb North Korea. I think that what happened, again, we should not give Trump credit for anything. Like, even though this is good that Trump is the first president to actually want to meet with Kim Jong-un, that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. We shouldn't give him credit because President Moon of South Korea had campaigned on this. This was literally a campaign. This is generated off of decades of South Korea rejecting U.S. militarism, taking over the country. We're talking about tens of thousands of U.S. troops who have been based in Korea, decimating the environment, violating human rights, and not being listened to by their leadership. And when we saw kind of semi-bloodless, you know, I wouldn't say revolution, but I mean, it was a bloodless kind of shift where it was a regime change where President Moon got in on this peace platform of reunification. And that's the vast majority of Koreans want reunification. So this was going to go on with or without the U.S. in some way or another. I think that Trump allowing, you know, entertaining the possibility is a good thing. And I really think it shows you how vile and despicable just the entire establishment is, as I don't know if it's the reptilian brain that's been activated that they just want to hate everything that Trump does. But the fact that they're painting this as a bad thing and actually egging him on, like, it kills me. I mean, Ronan Farrow, for example, I think MSNBC pundit, you know, mocking Trump, holding that envelope and saying this is a propaganda coup. This is why all other presidents didn't meet with genocidal dictators. Really? That's funny, because I think that you guys meet with genocidal dictators all the time, and not just meet with them, you arm them and actually destroy their countries so you can prop them up and support them financially. So that's the way that we roll. So it's just disgusting to see the constant undermining and belittling of something that's actually finally good, that Korea can finally have peace. And another big so to answer your point, I don't know what's going to happen. Anything could happen, because as we know, just a couple weeks ago, Trump said he's pulling out. You know, and then this letter happened, and then Trump said he's coming back in. So I think that Trump desperately wants some sort of win here. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he's trying to just do this so then the liberal establishment will have no choice but to say this is good if it really does go through. I just really find it hard to believe that the U.S. empire, the machine that's going to churn on with or without Trump, is going to allow a communist country like that to have normal relations with South Korea. And again, we know that Kim Jong-un, when we're talking about denuclearizing the peninsula, he wants to denuclearize us, not just us in America, obviously. He's talking about the region. So removing the B-52 bombers from Guam, removing the torpedo submarines that, you know, daily do mock invasions and regime change overthrows of Kim Jong-un, removing the tens of thousands of troops from South Korea. So these are the things that the U.S. media and the political establishment would have never even entertained as a concession. And I think that's really telling, too. So a lot to foresee, a lot of unknowns. But I think that any way you slice this right now, it's amazing. Although the biggest worry is that Trump is really going to fuck it up, because he has all these crazy rabid neoconservatives in his ear. Pompeo and Bolton, I mean, we know what they want. We know what they think about Korea. And it just seems a little bit strange that this would all be allowed to go on. But again, time will tell. But, you know, it's a beautiful thing to have Korea in peace talks. I mean, I just never thought that I'd see it.
I mean, it's a really complicated situation. Yeah. I think that the kind of the background history piece that you did on the Korean War and the situation with North Korea is very interesting. I don't know. I mean, I think it's hard for a lot of people that are not following international geopolitics to really you know, because Trump, like you said, is just so batshit crazy. So it's like, where, you know, I think a lot of people always wonder, like, is this like a smokescreen for some, like, you know, bigger thing that's happening behind the scenes? Like, is he just pretending to be so stupid? Or is, like, this really how he is? You know, what, and also, like, who's really calling the shots? Is, like, you know, is Trump just some, like, you know, person that's out in front and really other people are directing it? Like, are there five Dick Cheneys behind him that are really setting policy?
Yeah.
I think that's a big question a lot of people have.
Yeah. And if, like, he really was interested in peace with Korea, why did he bring on John Bolton and all these crazy rabid people? You know, it doesn't make sense logically. And I kind of agree with you that there might be some sort of bigger policy at play here. I mean, I hate to give him too much credit at this 4D chess shit, but I mean,
sure.
It just seems like something bigger is at play again. Like, will the empire really allow the demilitarization of the entire Korean Peninsula? I mean, again, we want to eventually go to the Asia pivot to surround China. And that's been at play for at least a decade. So I find it hard to believe that we would have, quote unquote, a propaganda coup on behalf of North Korea to basically humiliate the U.S. empire.
And just real quick, you know, last time around we talked a lot about Bannon, but how does Bannon compare to Bolton exactly on this, broadly speaking?
I think Bannon, you know, people like to paint Bannon as an anti-interventionist, and we know that that's not true either. I hate these tropes like that the alt-right has created of Bannon was the one, you know, Bannon was the one who was really holding, you know, keeping Trump from holding back on war. And then the deep state pushed him out. No, dude, this guy was like a Reagan idol. He literally, like, his dick was hard for Reagan and the warmongering from that time, the Iran-Contra scandal. I mean, this is the reason that he got into politics. So I just find it a little bit gross to even give Bannon credit for anything. I mean, he might not have had his sights focused on Korea because he hated Muslims much more than Asian people, although we know how he felt about Asian people as well. But yeah, I mean, there's no comparison when you look at someone like Bolton. Absolutely not. I mean, this guy is literally the most dangerous, one of the most dangerous figures in the entire political arena.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to turn now to immigration. You know, at a recent campaign rally, Trump said something kind of as an aside while he was talking, but he's like, you know, we really need these migrants. Obviously, they're an integral part of the economy. But at the same time, I mean, the last couple of weeks, you know, we've just seen horrific news coming out about, you know, undocumented children being lost in these centers, and also people behind ICE saying, like, you know, we do this as a deterrent. I'm just curious, I mean, do you see anything coming out of this? You know, is that a tension within the elites, you think, of this immigration policy on one hand of admitting that, yes, the U.S. economy is very much dependent on this subservient class of people, you know, engaging in low paid work. But at the other, you know, on the other hand, you know, we're siphoning them into these privately run immigrant detention centers.
This is a horrifying issue, and separating children from their families is one of the most egregious forms of psychological torture that exists. And I have seen those reports going around. There's an ACLU report being passed around about children in these cages and just the complete violence and sexual abuse from Border Patrol and ICE agents. However, that ACLU report was actually under the Obama administration. So before we get into Trump, we have to understand Obama was doing this too. There's a reason why he was called the deporter in chief, and his administration ejected humans at a higher rate than any U.S. president before him, 2 million people. However, Trump is deporting more people at this moment at a higher rate. You know, capitalism obviously doesn't want all immigrants gone. Entire industries are run off undocumented labor. The agricultural industry obviously depends and thrives on undocumented immigrants. Everyone's wages would go up if everyone was paid above the table. And I don't think that capitalists want to replace these super exploited people with other people. I think that they, like you said, I mean, the industry and capitalism runs on the super exploitation of immigrants. I think that this is a tactic. It's a tactic on both sides. It's a tactic for right-wingers to drum up their base, this xenophobic, racist bigotry where Trump just has the chant, you know, this racist chant and call for the wall. And then liberals can utilize this to basically pull on liberals' heartstrings and pretend like it wasn't happening before. You know, there is no argument that's valid about being anti-immigrant. They have no negative impact on our lives at all. They add to the economy. They add to our culture. I think it's important to remind everyone that Reagan, as much of a piece of shit he was, he gave amnesty for all undocumented immigrants before he left office. So this is not an unfounded thing. We need to stop punching down toward the suffering people in this country and who's being marginalized and oppressed the most. I mean, back to the wall thing, the thing that trips me out the most of this mindless chant for a wall is that we have a wall. We have a wall. I've been to the border. It's militarized to the teeth.
Right.
These fascist gangs where ICE, you know, and again, I don't you know, I did say that Obama was doing this, and obviously this is not a new thing. But under Trump, ICE has been emboldened, where they say our jobs are fun now. And we know that they've been given a green light to now go into hospitals and stock churches and just they have no limitations at all. So it's literally like fascist brown shirt gangs just going around and you know, deporting people en masse. But again, back to the wall. I mean, this is a wall that's been in place for decades. This is this started back this whole policy basically after NAFTA when immigration skyrocketed because of the policies from the Clinton administration. In 1994, Border Patrol set a policy called death as a deterrent. So after this wall was built, they strategically built the wall to funnel immigrants and migrants seeking refuge into the most death-defying routes in the desert in order to basically die. On purpose. And so that would be a deterrent, right? So other people wanting to flee to America would be told these horror stories of all the people who died and they just wouldn't come. Well, unfortunately, what we've seen is all death and no deterrence. And then we have things like Operation Streamline, where you just have something that looks like it's out of a gulag, where judges are trying upwards of 80 people at a time in these mass immigration trials. We snuck into one and filmed one in hidden cameras. You guys can check out in our documentary, The Empire's War on the Border. But it is so criminal what's going on. It's been happening for so long. And it's just these mindless MAGA chuds who have no, like, they just love this rhetoric. And then the liberals pretend like it's something new, you know, when this right. has been going on for so long, where literally hundreds of people are dying every year in the desert. I mean, we went out on one of these routes to leave water, which, by the way, is a felony offense now. You know, right. You can leave water for animals escaping fires, but if you leave water for a migrant in the desert, you get charged with a felony. That's how much we care about human beings and immigrants. So this isn't new. It is something that has been exacerbated to a very sickening fascist point where, again, I mean, ICE should be abolished, and that's without question. And it's stunning that people are even trying to argue that point. I mean, ICE was created in this post 9/11 sweep where there was just cash injections being funneled to all of these new agencies being created. DHS and ICE were two new completely agencies created after 9/11 that were just funneled and pumped with tens of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. But you got to create those jobs, got to keep those jobs, right? So we got to keep the Nazis employed, deporting people en masse. But, you know, where is this going to go? I don't know. We already know that the Dreamers who are being deported, some kid just got killed in Mexico who told Customs, he was like, I am going to die if you deport me. I mean, he lived right. his whole life here until high school, and then he got killed within weeks of going back to Mexico. So, I mean, immigration is amazing. And these people, we have a lot to learn from people who are coming here in, by the way, which was Mexico not too long ago. So all these asshole bigots and racists, they might want to look around and look at the street names around them and understand where what place they actually are stepping foot on.
Right. And even statistically speaking, there's more migrant people leaving the United States than there are entering it.
So yeah, good point. Totally. Good point.
I just wonder, like, in, you know, 10 or 15 years, if the projections are correct, if, you know, automation ends up destroying or negatively impacting half of the jobs that are out there, which all the studies say, and, you know, half of us are working gig economy jobs, which is what a lot of the studies say, if any of this rhetoric around immigrants is still going to fly, because I don't think anybody's going to believe it when a robot is standing right where you used to work and everybody else has tried to get out of the United States because it's a shithole.
Yeah, good point. That's a really, really good statistic that no one talks about is all the people that are fleeing. Right. Unbelievable.
Well, I wanted to turn now in the Empire Files in December of last year, you took on the topic of opioids. And I think this is a really important topic to talk about. Feels like not enough people are really discussing this, but just talk about, you know, what is there to talk about opioids and what, you know, what is the connection between corporations and this overdose epidemic that's, you know, happening across the nation?
Yeah, I'm sure all of us know someone who suffered from opioid addiction. I actually was briefly addicted to opioids. I was given Vicodin for my wisdom teeth And it's like, that's how easy it is. You know, you get a bottle of Vicodin and you're addicted. It takes 7 days. Like, it's very easy. And they pass this out like candy. I mean, it's getting a little bit better now, but back when this all started, it was really bad. And I'm going to get into that in a second. But first of all, everyone should know that over 100 people are dying every day in this country from opioid overdoses. And that's not just OxyContin and Vicodin. That's also morphine and heroin, because when people obviously don't have access to the pill mill or to the pharmacy, then they'll go to the street. And that's, you know, you saw Philip Seymour Hoffman die from fentanyl laced heroin. And you see a lot more danger because your body is in so much pain that you have to go and get heroin or methadone. And that's so dangerous. You know, and addiction rates also have skyrocketed like 500% over the last 6 years. So how is this the fault of corporations? Well, basically it is. It's what the fuck is that? That's the corporation who like owns OxyContin is also invested in all of these museums like the Getty. I forget what their name is, but basically what they did is they knew how addictive opioids were, just like the tobacco companies. You know, they knew how addictive cigarettes were. And just like Sun knew climate change was real, and they basically utilized that knowledge and implemented it into their business plan. So they preyed on Native American reservations and economically desperate people to set up pill mills. Internal documents show that these companies knew exactly the addiction rates they knew and maximized their profits from it. They hired scientists to put out fake studies, and they basically paid doctors to get perks and developed these pill mills, which are kind of the intermediary between the corporations who are manufacturing and obviously the doctors. These pill mills are supposed to, you know when there's an influx and an outrageous amount of pills being ordered, you know, and not allow that to happen. But instead they didn't. They basically sold up to 7 million pills in a town with a population of like 3 million. I mean, that's how much they were pushing this shit, knowing what it was doing to the population, where people would be literally like around the block, getting pills, with barely any oversight whatsoever. So there's pamphlets put out, describing them as addiction free. And Purdue, the companies like Purdue and McKesson, were keeping this lie alive for decades. And they specifically, like I said, I mean, targeted the most economically desperate, poorest areas and preyed on just vulnerable people who were suffering. West Virginia, the poverty-stricken mining area of West Virginia, got hit the hardest. There's tons of documentaries out about the pill mills there, but it was devastating. And what this did was turn these companies into, I mean, some of these companies started off as $500 million companies and they turned into a $500 billion industry within months. And again, this was part of their business plan. So I spoke to the main lawyer who fought the big tobacco case. His name is Mike Papantonio, and he's a tort reform lawyer that's taking on now these drug pushers. Because even though some lawsuits were settled in some of these states, you know, the money was funneled down and no one who was actually affected by this crisis actually saw the cash. And so he's taking them on again, and he thinks it could be a lawsuit that's actually bigger than big tobacco. But the question remains of what happens to the rest of people who are still suffering. I mean, already hooked on this stuff. It's really, really, really sad.
Yeah. Well, thank you for covering that and bringing, you know, at least some of this to light. And just moving forward, you know, you've done some new shows on U.S. involvement, as we were talking about before, you know, propping up and helping, you know, various right-wing and anti-union forces in Colombia and Venezuela. I don't know what direction you want to go into this, but I mean, let's talk about some of this this work that you've been doing on U.S. intervention in these countries.
Yeah. So Colombia and Venezuela are two really interesting cases. I mean, they're neighboring countries. We hear a ton about one of them. We don't hear anything about the other. You know, constant threats of regime change in Venezuela. As I mentioned, the sanctions that are very debilitating. For example, I just saw a Washington Post headline saying it's time for a military coup because coups can sometimes lead to democracy. Foreign Policy magazine another day, another publication just casually suggesting an undemocratic coup of a leader in another nation, saying it's time. You have Marco Rubio, Tillerson, Pompeo, and Trump himself, Haley as well, all threatening a military coup for Venezuela. So we hear about that constantly, right? It's a starving nation. People are suffering. The rats, they're eating rats. And meanwhile, in neighboring country, Colombia just joined NATO randomly. Like, wow, that's interesting. Colombia is a country that we've injected $10 billion over the past 10 years in Plan Colombia. First, it started off as fighting leftists and communists back during the Kennedy Doctrine, when you know, everyone likes to paint Kennedy as this hero. I mean, he fucking created the paramilitary death squads in Colombia. And because of that era of decimating anyone who was a leftist, a peasant, anyone who was remotely progressive or poor would just wiped out in mass. I mean, tens of thousands of people were slaughtered during those decades that Kennedy was overseeing this or Kennedy started that policy back in the day. So then it switched to the war on drugs. So once communism was quote unquote over, then it became all about fighting cocaine trafficking. Oddly enough, it's just skyrocketed since then. And it's very interesting. The border is porous as fuck. I was there myself. I walked from one. I mean, it's like anyone can traffic and smuggle whatever they want across. It's quite amazing. I don't know where all this money is going, if it's supposed to stop cocaine trafficking. So anyway, here we are today, where the state of both countries is very stark. And it's also, you cannot look at these countries in a vacuum without understanding how they've been shaped by the empire and by imperialism. And in Colombia, you have a country that's basically been run by the fascistic elements of the right-wing party for quite some time. And this has obviously been, you know, allies with the U.S. They're one of the U.S.'s biggest recipients, I think third in the world in terms of military aid. Colombia, the people that want to be in power are in power, and they're suppressing the rights of workers and unions. And there's ongoing massacres of leftists, and it's all backed by U.S., to put down poor people. I mean, right now in Colombia, it's the most dangerous country in the world to be a trade unionist. I met with a teacher there who lives in fear. His colleague got beaten to a pulp and is now paralyzed. He had to live in exile for years outside of the country because of the death threats. The impunity for these killings is, I mean, unbelievable. There is no accountability whatsoever. Every 3 days, a social leader is executed there. It's very, very scary, because it's not, you know, Mexico has a similar amount of violence, and there are actually leaders being killed there too. But in Colombia, it's specific targeting of people who are community leaders. And it's really, really scary, right? Because they're trying to take them out at the knees to prevent further mobilization. And you see that in the rest of the world. You know, here we are facing these cataclysmic environmental catastrophes. And what are the world's governments and corporations doing in response? They're executing the people who are putting their bodies on the line to fight this. Mm-hmm. That's what the system is doing. Assassinating the people who are willing to risk their lives to stop this environmental degradation. I mean, you really have to look at the system a little bit differently when you look at that. So in Colombia, it's the most stark example of this. I mean, you have a presidential election that just happened, where in a couple weeks there's a runoff, and it's going to be really bad, because the runoff is looking likely like the right wing is going to win, Uribe's party, when Santos's party, who was in power, actually did put through a peace deal with the FARC, which ended this 50-year civil war, mm-hmm. Which was a really big hopeful time for the country to really, you know, move forward. FARC could finally have a seat at the table, demilitarize. And unfortunately, since that time has happened, the killings haven't stopped. The killings haven't stopped. And unfortunately, they're taking place in a lot of the formerly held FARC areas. So the impunity is still there. Paramilitaries are still acting. And there's no accountability. And I actually confronted one of these congressmen who was just a total fascist about his party's ties to death squads. And it was just disgusting. I mean, it's so tragic what's going on there. Meanwhile, in Venezuela, the opposite is happening, where the poor working class faction, is in power and has been since 1999. This is the offset of the Bolivarian Revolution, the Hugo Chavez-led movement. Chavismo is still alive and well, despite the horrific economic state in the country right now, which really says a lot. So you just saw an election there where Maduro won with 4 million votes. And what the U.S. government basically did, on top of funding the right-wing opposition for the past 10 years with $50 million, they've basically been pressuring all the opposition to not run in these elections and to boycott them, to make the process look illegitimate, and then to basically further the call for regime change and foreign powers to come in there and save Venezuela. Right. And so with this last election, they encouraged all the opposition to not run, to make Maduro run and unopposed and look ridiculous. And instead, two opposition members ended up running against him, and the U.S. went and tried to beg them to drop out because they wanted, you know, the election to look illegitimate. So, you know, this is a country that actually has empowered the poor, empowered the working class. There's completely different class dynamics in both countries. And obviously Venezuela having the largest oil reserves in the world and a system that represents the poor, it's a very stark class struggle in that country. And I encourage, you know, it's super complicated in terms of the economics, but John Oliver just did this disgraceful hit piece on Venezuela leading up to the election where he dedicated an entire show to just regurgitating the most garbage debunkable arguments mm-hmm. that basically echo the Trump administration. And at the end of the episode, he has the audacity to be like, so what can we do? Well, the sanctions, brings up the sanctions as if that's good. And he was like, if Trump's not careful, the sanctions could really hurt more. I'm like, are you fucking crazy? You're actually calling for sanctions. Like, aren't you a comedian? It was just like insane to me. So anyway, my partner, Mike Preisner, did this absolutely epic takedown of everything that John Oliver said that I really encourage anyone who really wants to understand this issue a little bit deeper to look beyond the headlines, because it really just debunks all the most tired right-wing tropes about that country. But I mean, it's just unbelievable what the U.S. has been doing. Mm-hmm. Look, I'm not going to, like, we can talk all day about what's going on and the problems and all that stuff. But the biggest point is that the masses of people that support Hugo Chavez and still support Maduro have been rendered invisible to U.S. Western media sources and corporate media. And it's just a disgrace to render these people who are you know, they paint them as, oh, the most poor, suffering, desperate people are, they're all starving and they're all under dictatorship. Why is it then that the masses of poor and most desperate people all support the government? Why is that? It's just the narrative really just flips on its head when you realize that this is actually a class struggle at its heart.
And you did some videos where you went out and you talked to some of the opposition people in the street. I mean, they're dressed a lot like a lot of the alt-right people with like body armor and stuff, kind of like makeshift things like that. I mean, where are these people coming from that are taking to the streets and fighting against the leftist government?
Oh yeah. So another part in John Oliver's segment, he interviews one woman who's like the militia, you know, everyone, it's just so fucking insane. This woman is like, the militias will come kill you if you speak out. Well, first of all, she's speaking out on TV. Second of all, there's tens of thousands of people when I was in Venezuela every day in the streets, voicing their dissent, protesting peacefully, you know, and I talked to a lot of them. A lot of them were more white, more upper class. A lot of them said they can't buy the things that they want. They're restricted. You know, that kind of mentality where if you go to a pro-government march, also just as strong, tens of thousands of people in the street, they're more black, Afro-Venezuelan, indigenous, poor. But as far as the opposition protests, that's kind of what you see, right? You see the masses of people and we're never shown the other side. But then there's another element of these protests that's actually glorified and lauded by people like John Oliver and Vice News, where the Guarimba aspect of the protests, where these people will, the mask protesters in the front. And I have to say this, that there's a certain tendency on the left and the more anarchist factions of the left that basically fetishize protests everywhere and fetishize revolution, and without looking at the character of protests or if they're progressive or not. And this is a perfect aspect of that, which is Venezuela's protests, even though there were masses who were peaceful, there was a very fascistic element of the street guarimbas that were sustaining a very terrifying campaign of violence across the country. I myself was chased out of the country by a virtual lynch mob for simply reporting on the deaths that they were causing. I saw myself what happened. I mean, I'll just give you a really quick rundown. I was at one of these giant opposition protests, and as the night comes, the Guarimba takes hold, where the mask protesters, armed with guns, rocket launchers, Molotov cocktails, and God knows what else, would commandeer 18-wheeler trucks, burn down buses, attack maternity clinics, burn them down, basically attack anything that represented the social programs of the Maduro government. So there was several executions of socialist candidates for the Constituent Assembly. A lot of these deaths were outright assassinations of socialists. At least three people were burned alive during the course of the protests. One person was burned alive on camera. And he was told right before he died in the hospital, he said that he was told, hey, black guy, this is what happens to Chavistas, before they doused him in gasoline. I saw firsthand that, you know, these people ran up to me and they were like, who the fuck do you work for? And I was like, I'm an American journalist. I was like, I'm here to tell your story. And they were like, just show what the government does to us. Don't show what we do. And what they did was burn down the freeway, like I said, commandeering trucks, pulling truck drivers out of their vehicles, burning them down. Multiple people, dozens of people actually died from being trying to get away from these flaming barricades on the freeways in motorcycles or cars. A lot of these, a lot of just burning down neighborhoods, essentially, just the sustained violence. And that was and basically a lot of these times you'll see Vice, John Oliver, just again glorifying them and saying, like, John Oliver, for example, was like, wow, these protesters are restrained. He actually fucking said they're restrained after they've burned alive black people for being black. Like, that's fucking Nazi shit, man. So the fact that you're saying they're restrained is sick. And it's just disgusting. It's like, how do you whitewash this shit? Like, so it's just so detrimental for people watching this to think that. And it's the same with like the Ukraine stuff. I mean, the neo-Nazi presence in Ukraine was totally whitewashed by Vice too. So, but I talked to some of these protesters again. Unlike Vice and unlike John Oliver, I actually went to these masked Guarimba protesters on the front lines. And I said, why are you holding them up? Why are you holding a grenade? Can you tell me what you're doing? And the guy said, I can't be an entrepreneur. I can't be an entrepreneur here. It's really hard to own a business.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is like, I thought, like, what the fuck? You guys are painted as starving. Why are you burning down food distribution warehouses with tons of food inside? I mean, basically what it is, and this is a cynical, it's really cynical. It's a stunt. It's a stunt to basically create an international spectacle in order to beg for regime change. And a lot of these people said, we need help. We need the U.S. to come and overthrow Maduro. And it's just really unfortunate. Like, it's really unfortunate that there's this violent fascistic wing of the protests that have caused a lot of the death and destruction.
Right. Well, I can say that people within the anarchist movement were definitely not supporting them. In fact, you know, people saw very much so that they were obviously influenced by a lot of the stuff that was happening in the United States, especially like after the Berkeley protests. And even like some of the alt-right figures here in the U.S., like Bay Stickman, he even took credit and said, like, they copied, you know, my look and my fighting style directly. And it was because of me that they basically took on this street fighting, you know, tactics or whatever, you know, in the fight against the Venezuelan state. But wow, that's really intense. But
it was, and they shot my colleague in the back too, because after they found out who we were, they wanted to spread this fake news story that got viral and repeated by a lot of opposition press that I was actually a spy, just because I was there trying to get two sides of the story. I was like, I'm here to tell your story. Like, I'm you know, I'm doing my job as a journalist. And they basically painted us as spies. And they said, I mean, I've never, you know, and again, the character of the movement was very exposed even in the threats, because they were all lynch threats and burn her alive.
Wow.
And I have hundreds of these. And that really says a lot, I think, when you resort to that kind of rhetoric.
Yeah, well, especially those tactics too, because it's about people seeing somebody hung, somebody seeing somebody burn. Wow, that's really intense. Well, we're gonna turn now to another topic on the Empire Files, called the Hidden War on Trans Rights. And I think that a lot of people really paid attention to when Trump, you know, said that transgender people were not gonna be allowed in the military, and then that was taken away, and then all of a sudden we woke up and it was somehow back on the table. And I think a lot of us don't even know, did that go through? Like, what's going on, and how does this relate to that episode of the Empire Files as well?
So, wow, good question. I actually didn't know that there was a stall on that. I just assumed it did. But what's unfortunate though, is that that's kind of what people know, and that's where it ends. Right. So a lot of people are not sympathetic at all, because they're like, who gives a fuck about the military? Mm-hmm. I think it's really, and the transphobia is so disgusting to me. And obviously I don't see it every day because I'm not trans myself, but wow, putting this episode out and seeing the reactions were pretty depressing, because you really want to think that people, you know, that transphobia is not as pervasive as it really is, but damn. We have a really, really long road ahead of us for people to really understand and have basic humanity, because like the majority of responses were just like, why do they want special rights?
Right.
You know, and I was like, well, first of all, let's start at the beginning, which is that there is already 30 states, over half the country, that you can be legally fired on the basis of having a non-conforming gender identity.
Right.
You can also be legally evicted from your home for nothing more than being transgender. And of course, not, you know, those laws alone already, that doesn't affect like the prejudice that's just ingrained, where employment, housing, healthcare, obviously that's going to be way more commonplace regardless of legal backing, which is why 70% of trans people report hiding their gender identity just to avoid discrimination. I mean, and that is an devastating thing, because as we know, the rate of suicide is double that of the general population, four times more than for trans people of color. I mean, there is a huge epidemic here that no one is talking about, because people are just, because of class society. I mean, really, it does go back to this creation of like gender norms and family values and, you know, I mean, trans people have always existed. This discriminatory bent on class society in its present form, basically, I mean, it developed like these family codes, you know, laws and family codes enforcing this new system and leaving transgender people out in the dust when for thousands of years they've been highly revered in human society. You can find burials of transgender people from thousands of years ago. So this viciously repressive atmosphere is relatively new in human society, and really with the development of class society. But even before Trump kind of got the green light with his crazy evangelical wing behind him to steamroll this anti-trans agenda, even before that, in 2016, 50 bills were introduced in Congress targeting trans people. 50 bills. So even though we just heard, you know, Trump comes in and does this military ban on trans people, and it received widespread coverage, but that was not the start of it. I mean, he has really taken this and ran with it. I mean, you look at these laws, there's dozens and dozens that have been repealed. The assault has been full-fledged. He's canceled landmark legislation in the Department of Education, Department of Housing and Urban Development. The Justice Department has launched multiple attacks. And the Department of Health and Human Services has opened a so-called Religious Freedom Division to protect hateful doctors and hospitals that want to refuse healthcare to LGBTQ patients. So even though Obamacare was trash, there still was a protection for trans people to get healthcare in it. So it's a devastating, devastating underreported phenomenon. And the discrimination, even among liberals, they want to pretend like they're tolerant, but I really did see firsthand how little people really care about this issue. And it's a disgrace.
Would you say it's fair to say that, that kind of push that's coming from Trump, is that from like the Dominionist and evangelical, like faction of his base?
Oh, hell yeah. Do you see trans people is like the rallying cry?
That's the rallying cry.
Some person ran for senator in California. I almost lost my shit. It was just his entire platform was just a war on trans people. Like, right. Can you imagine looking at the world today and being like, you know what? My number one issue is actually eliminating trans people and getting them all like gender conversion therapy. Like, wow. Wow.
There was a documentary that came out recently that basically was arguing that essentially like all of their talking points and all of the kind of spiels that they had developed around gay marriage, they basically took that and said, okay, we're going to basically apply this to transgender rights. Because it's the same thing. It's like they want special rights and they want their own bathroom even. And, you know.
Oh, I mean, gender is fluid. Sexuality is fluid. This has been proven by science. So I don't, I mean, just, yeah. And it, that, to answer your question, absolutely. This is like throwing red meat to the evangelical wing. And this is throwing red meat to the maggot chud pilled, red pilled morons who lap up everything that Steven Crowder and like Ben Shapiro say, mm-hmm. because they love to rant and, rant against trans people, rant against the bathroom, the dangers of having a trans person in the bathroom. And just rail and rail against these imaginary tropes that have been debunked over and over again to just, again, just build, foment hysteria and fear. Because, of course, that's why we know these grifters rely on just people being scared shitless of anything that they don't understand.
What I find very interesting about them, though, is on one hand, they're like, you know, you can't let them in the bathroom. But on the other hand, they say, well, there's no such thing as rape culture. And, you know, women don't get sexually assaulted at college. So it's like this double thing where, you know, trans people are going to break into any bathroom they see and molest a child as soon as they can get their hands on it. But yet, you know, rape culture doesn't exist. That's not a thing.
These whiny babies who – none of their arguments hold any water. I mean, yeah, of course, nothing they say makes sense because they just have meaningless rhetoric that has no leg to stand on. Like, for example, their entire victimhood mentality, yet they deflect everything on how liberals are snowflakes and we're all like – like leftists are like, want to be the victims. It's like, dude, you guys are just constantly victimizing yourselves. It's pathetic.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to ask you real quick, since we kind of got on this topic, somebody asked us the other day, but, you know, what advice would you give to students that are going to campus and they see groups like Turning Point USA that have access to all these resources that are backed by the Koch brothers, that have, you know, money flowing in from all these big foundations? What advice would you give to students that are organizing, that are seeing like these groups pop up that have all this money?
Yeah, man, it's a really, really difficult point because, as you just said, there's billions of dollars in this vacuum of the right-wing media machine, the Mercers, the Koch brothers, and they'll set up endless shell organizations to create these false debates, right? The free speech debate has been a manufactured thing from Turning Point USA, from the Charles Kirks and Candace Owens of the world, to basically foment this hysterical fake thing where they bring controversial figures to the most like not liberal, obviously, like the most heated, you know, Berkeley, obviously, Antifa is going to come out, or Manhattan, which is like a very big progressive hub. So they want to create that controversy to then become victims. It's very, very easy thing that they've generated for themselves. In terms of advice for people, I mean, it's hard to say, like, don't fall into that trap. Obviously, I do think that deplatforming these people is a good idea. I think the best route is to just like shut them down. Like, I mean, Dave Rubin just had this embarrassing event where some girl just got on the mic and just made him look like a complete dipshit. And I think, you know, getting into these spaces and just laughing, monopolizing the Q&A, yelling shit out during their talks. I mean, that's where we just need to take over their spaces. But if, you know, the big street battles and stuff, I think help them at the end, unfortunately, because then they'll utilize it to be like, it's a danger. Antifa's, you know, equatable to Nazis. And then you have the Mercers actually, while this free speech debate is going on, you have the Mercers silently pushing through legislation that will actually make protesting these speakers expellable. That you can actually be expelled from college if you try to engage in these. So it's tough. It's really, really tough because there's an endless amount of money up against grassroots organizing. So it's exposing them for who they are. I think Charles Kirk is such a laughable figure. I mean, we just need to show people them in diapers, slamming a little baby bottle toy on the ground and you know, and just show.
Well, you
just
know, that person quit the organization. I don't know if you saw that.
Couldn't handle it.
That person in the diapers, yeah, just quit. we're going to go ahead and skip 7 since we already talked about that. But, you know, moving on, there was a recent Zillow study, Zillow's housing website, of talking to various economists, and they all placed the next recession happening in 2020. I'm just curious your thoughts. If there was another recession, which most people agree that it's going to happen because capitalism's a cycle of boom and bust, but what would that mean for working and poor people right now, people that still haven't recovered from 2008? What's it going to look like the next time this thing explodes?
It's going to look really bad, man. We know from 2008 that the top 1% took over 95% of all the recovery funds. So, you know, and I love how the government looks at the stock market and they're like, the stock market's doing great, therefore the economy is doing great. It's like, who the fuck gauges the stock market on how the economy is doing? It's a total Ponzi scheme. And then you just saw that study where the median household income of millennials is 40 grand, 20% less than baby boomers. 20% less at the same stage of life we're earning than our parents. I mean, that is really insane, despite being better educated. So basically, millennials have half the net worth of our parents. The home ownership rate is lower. Student debt is drastically higher. That's just in one generation. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, of course there's going to be a recession. Booms and busts are not only built into the economy, they are by design. So the top 1% can continue to extract more and more wealth and consolidate more and more wealth. So this is built in. This is why a planned economy is ideal, or some sort of plan behind the economy. Every time there's a boom, they get richer. Every time there's a bust, we get poorer. And it's just going to keep going through disaster after disaster. And, you know, just for example, I mean, the fact that our economy is based on overproduction when it used to be based on scarcity. Like, for example, I mean, how much food is wasted because it's all just based on speculative nonsense. 40% trashed. We have 6 homes for every homeless person empty in this country. I mean, it's just astounding that crises are actually formed from having an overproduction of something that we have too much of.
Right.
I mean, that is a really fatal flaw in the system. So, you know, that's how recessions happen, because of the overproduction, like the housing market. So it's really disturbing to see the trajectory of how the economy has shifted from being scarcity driven to now where we are today. We're defined by overproduction. And, you know, back in the past, there was floods and droughts, and that shaped the economy. And now we have, you know, too much of shit. Mm-hmm. It's really, really insane. And of course, this is going to hit the poor and working class the most. And all the rich have to do is just get bailed out by the government, and there's no risk for them. There's absolutely no risk for them ever. And
we'll they're start just right backing keep, over.
Yeah. Mergers, acquisitions, monopolizations. And that's what happens also. It's not that they just like acquire the vast majority of the wealth. They're also going to monopolize the industries that fall and fold into them. And that's what we saw also during the 2008 collapse. Like, a lot of these industries were monopolized and eaten up by bigger ones. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, like, I don't even think anyone went to jail for the 2008 crisis.
No.
I really don't. And they got bonuses after the bailout. Remember?
Perhaps some people from Enron might have done some time, but, I mean, nothing on a grand scale. I mean,
there's, yeah, Obama protected these assholes.
There was no SWAT teams raiding any, you know, white-collar criminals.
Unbelievable, man. I mean, it's really it's unfortunate, but it is going to happen, and we have to be prepared.
Right.
Well, I think just investing in like a local bank is the best way to do it.
Just one more kind of like longer term looking economic question. I mean, like, looking at the G7 meeting right now, I mean, it's kind of funny because just the hatred and the stuff that a lot of the finance people are saying, you know, about Trump's America First, you know, tariffs that he's proposing and stuff like that. How do you see, like, if the U.S. continues to tank and, like, you know, go down as far as it's standing in the world, you know, compared to other nations, how will that impact, do you think, foreign policy coming out of the United States?
That's an interesting question. I think that the trade war is really funny because Trump made himself sound like, all we need to do is just make a good deal. He's like, it's really, really simple. We just apply tariffs and then China's going to pay them. And China was just like, what the fuck are you talking about? We're just going to apply tariffs to our exports to you, motherfucker. And then you're going to pay the loss. And that's exactly what we're seeing. It's like Trump is just dumb as shit. And all of his supporters are too, where they actually believed him when he said, like, people, I mean, I saw Candace Owens on the Joe Rogan show and it was mortifying. I've never seen someone more dumb.
What was she saying?
She said that Trump has helped the middle class, that deregulation helps. It's like, really? I'm pretty sure that deregulation helps corporations take on more risk at the expense of the middle class.
It's just like classic Reaganomics.
It's classic Reaganomics. And she was like, Trump, she was talking about the carrier thing, and she was like, Trump brought back all these jobs. It's like, that was a PR stunt.
No.
They ended up exporting all the jobs like a month later.
Exactly.
None of that is real. I think that I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not that strong on like the economics of what, you know, what could possibly happen with the trade war and stuff. But that definitely would drive foreign policy, because the empire is expansionist and so is capitalism. And that's what really drives the empire and why it has to grow. So, man, I mean, we know China is ultimately the prize, the ultimate right. competitor. And I don't know. I mean, we know that we're inching toward that Asia pivot. Like I mentioned, it's going to be an interesting time, especially since Trump has really revealed the true nature of the system.
Right. Well, turning now to Palestine, you've done a lot of work there. You know, recently there was the moving or the official recognition of an embassy in Jerusalem led to massive protests, you know, huge bloody clashes, you know, pretty horrific scenes. What's going to happen now? How is this going to impact, do you think, life in Palestine for people and also just resistance to the Israeli occupation?
Oh, man, this is a tough one. I mean, I think this is a flashpoint. I think this is a flashpoint of struggle, and I don't think it's going to be a deciding factor for anything. I think that what Netanyahu is doing is that he is emboldened, just like Trump and his base are, where Trump is essentially given carte blanche to Netanyahu to do whatever he wants, and they're being very hard under Trump. The settlements have skyrocketed. This Jerusalem embassy thing was really a slap in the face, and especially on so-called Israel Independence Day, which means something totally different for Palestinians, which is actually the like Nakba, which is the catastrophe where 750,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed during the foundation of Israel. So it's very offensive on its face to actually hold the Jerusalem embassy move on the day of the Nakba, especially with the initiation of these protests, which had already been going on for weeks and weeks, which already, you know, dozens of people had been massacred in cold blood by Israeli snipers that are perched up on a hill 100 meters away from, and I don't want to call it a border, that's a very big misnomer, it's a fence caging in 2 million people from their own homes and own land. So this border fence misnomer is really unfortunate, because it really is just a caged prison. 1.4 million people living in Gaza are refugees from the Nakba, who live literally just miles away from where they were ethnically cleansed from. It's absolutely insane. And I just had a press conference with journalists in Gaza, and I'm going to try not to cry right now because it's really, really intense. But it's, they basically told me, you know, they get a lot of Arabic media. They don't see a lot of English media, and they don't understand the complete uniformity of dehumanization of them and the way that they're painted like animals and the way that the media paints their struggle as that they are the causes of their own death, destruction, massacres, and misery. And what they told me was just unbelievable. I mean, they said, did people care? They said, did people care when we died? And I don't know what to say to that, because a lot of people didn't. And a lot of people blamed them for that. And they said, can you just please tell everyone that we love life and we want to live? And so to people like Jake Tapper and Bill Maher and all these motherfuckers who say that they have a martyrdom complex and that they want to die, like, I can't anymore, dude. Like, some of these people are actually way worse to me than even the most rabid Zionist neoconservatives, because they trick so many people into thinking that, like, just dehumanizing these people into thinking that there's some death cult, that people in Gaza want to die. They want to live. They want dignity and basic human rights and freedom. They're suffering under 97% of their water's contaminated with sewage. They can't leave. Their air, water, the mobility, it's all constricted by Israel. And so sometimes it's all they can do is basically, like, this guy just self-immolated. It was the first instance of a self-immolation in Gaza, 21-year-old man. This is what the desperation that they're driven to, where sometimes the only option that they have is to sacrifice themselves to somehow send a message to the rest of the world what Israel's doing and what, how much more naked could it be when you have 35,000 people who are unarmed, unarmed, and Israeli forces shoot dead. They shot 500 people in the head. That's how many people they wanted to kill. That's how many headshots there were. 500. 500. Not one Israeli casualty. They killed three journalists. In one day, they shot 1,350 people and killed 62. The death, I mean, 19 paramedics. I saw an interview with this one doctor on Democracy Now!, and he said that they were in a medical tent, which, by the way, Israeli forces had firebombed the morning of the massacre, as well as leveled the sand dunes to make it easier to kill people. They said that every time they would leave their their medical tent to go help people, the bullets would start flying. They were just waiting for them to go into the line of sight so they could try to kill all of them. Almost all of them were shot. One of them was killed. And we all know about Razan Al-Najjar, the 21-year-old medic who was just assassinated, a young feminist. Please watch her interview on the New York Times. She says that, you know, she's just talking about nonviolence and how she's a feminist. And she just said, we can do anything without weapons. And she was just like, it's overwhelming. Like, it really, really is overwhelming for me because where's the humanity, man? I mean, it's really intense, dude. And to see Nikki Haley run around like a fucking psychotic deranged person at the UN begging people to sign onto a resolution to blame Hamas for one of the most egregious massacres of unarmed protesters in the history of humanity. I mean, we've really crossed the point of no return here. And you know, I mean, I could just go on and on and on, but I mean, the fact that Israel said that, you know, she was a human shield. She was a human shield. Hamas did this. You morons for believing Hamas propaganda that, you know, well, we fell for it again. There is no peaceful protest because everything's staged by Hamas. I mean, it's just, how much longer are people going to buy this? I mean, it's just sick. And then you have Ramzi Najjar, the cousin of the murdered paramedic. After she was executed in cold blood, he goes to the fence and tries to cut it with the wire cutters, was immediately executed. You have the IDF saying they're going to start killing people who simply burn the kites and destroy property, even though you have colonial settlers burning down thousands of olive trees every year. You know, the day after this massacre, not only does Barry Weiss go on Bill Maher and say, you know, how disgusting that Hamas is making us pretend, like wants us to care about these dead kids. They staged this. And Bill Maher's like, yeah, totally. They staged what? They staged fucking what? Like, what is wrong with you people? And Dan Savage is sitting there nodding along mindlessly. It's astounding to me. And then the New York Times, the day after this massacre, has the audacity to put on their front page, Israelis reflect. I hope that at least every bullet was justified. That was the headline after this massacre. And then just yesterday, the village, the Ahed Tamimi, the amazing, heroic 17-year-old Palestinian who slapped the soldier across the fucking face. I don't know if she slapped him across the face, but she got arrested. And everyone's confused, like, oh my God, why did she slap the soldier? Well, it's because all of her family members keep getting executed and her village keeps getting raided arbitrarily by the colonial occupying soldiers that are illegally occupying their land. And just yesterday, her cousin was also executed by Israeli soldiers who let him bleed out and did not let medics or ambulances take him away to save him. So that's where we're at. I think that the biggest takeaway, and as I was talking to these journalists, in Gaza, I mean, the biggest silver lining here is that you do see people like Natalie Portman, who really were de facto like ambassadors for Israel forever. I mean, you see people like Sarah Silverman, Judd Apatow. I mean, these people were defending the massacre in Gaza back in 2014, and you see them changing their tune now. And so there really is a sea change. There is a silver lining where at this point, you look fucking maniacal if you're defending what's going on there. And there's not much longer this fascistic apartheid colonial state can last with the pressure that's building. I mean, Argentina just canceled a soccer match. I just think the boycott is going to go stronger and stronger. But again, as long as we're subsidizing the state with $10 million every single day, with tax dollars, I mean, again, that's why I focus on the U.S. empire, because I know that the U.S. empire will subsidize Israel even if the rest of the world boycotts it.
Right. Exactly. Well, you know, just in closing, kind of on that note, I thought it was kind of sick and sad. I was watching SNL recently, and they were talking about the embassy opening at the same time as the massacre was going on. Ivanka Trump was there with her husband, and it looked like they were about to kind of connect, you know, this like very, you know, stupid, you know, photo op and compare it to the massacre, which a lot of people did, you know, online. And they didn't. They just made some stupid joke about Ivanka Trump being stupid, which of course she is. But it just, to me, it really cemented that any sort of hope that under the Trump presidency that, you know, the center or even liberals that are kind of towing the DNC regimes, you know, talking points were going to like stick up for anybody. You know, it was just, you know, complete, you know, it's just not going to happen. And I don't know. I mean, I think that's just more and more clear. And I think that people, you know, listening to this program and, you know, watching Empire Files need to be more and more clear of that. I mean, any sort of like idea that they were going to kind of come to our side or help us or whatever is just, I mean, it's not going to happen.
I think quick point about that, and I couldn't agree with you more. There's window dressing and cosmetic changes that they're going to keep propagandizing people to be manipulated into supporting the two-party dictatorship. And if people aren't awake now to how much of a farce this is, I don't know what else it will take. The stakes keep getting higher. I just heard someone say that, you know, history repeats itself, but the stakes get higher every time. Mm-hmm. And it really stuck with me because, again, the cataclysmic environmental disasters, the climate refugees that are coming, all of these things, the never-ending wars, the degradation and destruction, the stakes are getting higher and higher. And what are the Republicans and Democrats doing? Well, the Republicans have opened their tent to everyone, rapists, Nazis. You could be anyone and anything and be in the Republican Party. In terms of the Democrats, they've closed themselves off and completely removed any ability to have any sort of progressive wing whatsoever. They've expunged the Dennis Kucinich's. We know what they did to Bernie Sanders, who I have a lot of problems with, but he was the best that we had in that, obviously, that cycle. And they refuse to eke even an iota left because they, again, I think we talked about this before, but it's better for them to have a fascist in office than to have an actual progressive. They, at the end of the day, their entire purpose is to hijack the revolutionary language of social movements and progressive ideals and utilize them to basically rebrand themselves in, you know, to couch themselves in either feminism or minority struggles where you had, you know, or ageism, for example, like Dianne Feinstein, who I think she's a disgusting corporate shill, but for some reason I was called an ageist because I didn't support her. I was like, how are we, like, come on here. So the Democrats, that's why they exist. They exist to fold the actual resistance in the streets into their base for voter presence. I mean, that's what they do every time. And I fear the DSA is just another tool to basically do this. I mean, we saw the Peace and Freedom Party, which fights rigorously for ballot access in California. And the DSA didn't even endorse any socialist candidates, including the treasurer position, who really could have steamrolled single payer through. And that was really disappointing. And I think this is just the modus operandi with the Democratic Party. They are going to posit themselves as the resistance, but we know that at every single point that really matters, they are not resisting anything. And in fact, like I said before about the big tent approach, well, they've not only closed themselves off to leftists, they're actually embracing anti-choice candidates now. Mm-hmm. So that's how far they'll go to try to galvanize and get Republican voters. But don't expect them to ever eke left. And I think that the only way that we can really fight this is for masses of people to be out in the street. That's the only way that you can move policy. I personally think that we need to overthrow the entire system. But until that happens, the only thing that will push these people is having tens of millions of people in the street demanding rights, humanity, and dignity for all the people that are marginalized and oppressed in this country right now and around the world.
Well, on that note, and to leave on a positive note, let's talk about some of the stuff that you got coming up on the Empire Files and any of your other work. Hopefully you're going to get paid soon.
Yeah, no, I think that we're going to get paid soon. And hopefully the, you know, Telesaur is able to thrive and sustain under this war. Last time I talked to you, I was going to go to Iran, and I don't want to make any predictions because it could all fall through again. So I don't know. We really want to do something big, mm-hmm. but, I really also want to do just a road trip in the U.S. and do a whole bunch of stuff on the way, including
awesome.
Native American reservations and just going to a bunch of different communities and seeing what happens on the way and seeing what stories come out of that. Cause I think that can, you know, sometimes the best things come out of something totally random when you're not planning it. But I do want to do a documentary on what I mentioned before, which is, you know, the state of the world and the environment and what is the system doing in response. And that is going to take, you know, it's going to be a large endeavor, but it really is a global thing. And but that is a really important issue that I feel like no one's really connected. And in terms of what else I really want to cover, also how Trump has ramped up the empire. I feel like, you know, in the Trump era, really quickly, I was worried because I was like, oh, it's going to be such an inundation of anti-Trump stuff and where, you know, how are progressives going to find their voice? And instead, it's been just Russia hysteria and nonsense and like zero like good critical analysis of empire or capitalism in terms of what Trump is doing and how it fits into the system. So I just think hammering still on those points and providing context and historical, like, you know, history is instructive and we need to learn from history and to be understanding how we got here. Nothing happens in a vacuum. So providing the context of all these things that Trump's doing, the collusion thing, how he's ramping up the empire, all these things I want to take on in the next season.
Awesome. Well, we look forward to seeing all that stuff play out and, you know, best of luck to you and good luck on all your endeavors and look forward to, especially that road trip. Sounds really awesome. Love to see
and
that.
Everyone support. It's going down. You guys are fucking awesome. I really like, it's really hard to find media content that's super quality, really inspiring, and just covers a huge swath of, you know, movements and topics. And I just really encourage everyone to donate to you and please support and share your work.
Thanks. Hey, best of luck to you and stay safe.
Thanks, man. You too. Peace.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.